Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. I guess I'm having too much fun already. I'm already having too much fun here. I'm so happy to be back here. Thank you for being here and making it possible for us to get to do this. We love it when you are here. And we got a great show for you. Second hour, we haven't talked with Father Tad for a good long while. Father Tad Poholchik will be our guest the second hour. And we'll do bioethics. If you have bioethics questions or you just want to hear about the latest kind of moral implications of what's going on in the bioethics field, like to get some insights into what's actually being done by the science and how we can think morally about what's being done with the science, that's for the second hour. First hour, a man of faith, a man of courage, someone I truly admire. I just want you to know that. Truly admire. Trent Horn, who is the host of Council of Trent, which you can find at TrentHornPodcast.com. But also, the most important thing about Trent, married to an extremely funny person who's been posting all sorts of hilarity on the web. And I say that mostly because I don't want her to turn her humor against me. I am trying to foster a good feeling so I don't become the target of one of her videos. Welcome, Trent.
Well, Cy,
I'm scared of her.
When my wife chooses to imitate people on her YouTube channel, it is a sign that that person is a Catholic celebrity.
Yeah. Okay. So then I'm safe. I appreciate that. I'm safe from that. But I saw the stuff she did about Matt Frad, and obviously she doesn't like Matt Frad. That came across quite clearly that she does not like him at all.
Oh, clearly. I think what came across clearly is that she loves Matt Frad and definitely enjoys Pints with Aquinas. It's just funny. It's like, oh, I wonder when we'll be talking about Aquinas at some point. I love Pints now, but the channel's aim has evolved over time. So she just made a little playful rib on that. But Matt still puts out, of course, wonderful content. Yeah. It's just funny to see how it's developed over time.
The number here is 888-318-7884. This hour, we'll do tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn. 888-318-7884. If you want to see what kind of tomfoolery they're producing in the Trent household. Wait, you got to, it just went out of my head.
Too Far with Laura Horn.
Oh, Too Far. Yeah. Too Far with Laura Horn is where to go. Too Far with Laura Horn. We already got a bunch of folks on the line. You got anything you want to talk about before we take the calls, or you want to just take the calls?
No, we can jump right in.
All right, we'll go to Wheaton, Illinois then, where Noah is on the line. Noah watching on YouTube. Glad you're here, Noah. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. So I watched your video called Matt Walsh, James White, and the Fear of Evangelism recently. And there's a clip that you cited in that video on the Council of Trent where James White debates the TV show host, and the TV show host cites the example of people with ovotestes or just certain ambiguous genitalia like that he used as evidence for transgenderism or rather that it's that male and female is not the only categories that we should put people in. And I know you've mentioned, you know, that many intersex people are the majority. You know, it's pretty easy to tell what sex they are. I'm just wondering, like, specifically in that instance, like of ovotestes or any other circumstance that it would be more ambiguous, or, you know, it's kind of one or the other or both even. How do you, like, how do you go about justifying, you know, either saying they're male or female in those circumstances, and how would you use that, how would you defend that in saying that we are all male and female even in those with those circumstances?
Sure. So the argument seems to be that people will make is that there is not a strict binary in sexual identity between male and female, because there might be cases where it's difficult for us to determine whether someone is male or female. These are very, there's two subsets. So these we call intersex cases. And as you noted, I would say in the vast majority of these cases, we are able to determine whether the person is male or female. They usually just have stunted sexual development or sexual organs that have not fully developed, but you can determine whether they're male or female. Before I get into answering that, though, I will say that this particular objection, I would say that it does not defend the transgender, it does not defend transgender ideology. Let's say there were individuals who we could not determine their biological sex. It would not follow that by the norm for biological sex is to be male or female. That wouldn't follow from these isolated cases where we're not sure. To give another example, there are cases of people who have severe brain damage where we're not sure if they're alive or dead. They're not responsive, but their bodies, their brain may be dead, but their bodies are still regulating, engaging in homeostasis. So these are very, very rare cases, and I call them interlife cases. But the fact that you have these very rare brain injury cases where you're not sure if the person is alive or dead, that wouldn't follow. We know there's a biological binary between life and death. So the fact that there are these cases where we're not sure, I would say that they don't show, for example, that maleness and femaleness or being a man or a woman is not primarily, well, solely, it's biological. Now, people might have different psychological conditions, different social customs surrounding being male or female. But at the end of the day, being a man or a woman is connected to biological reality, and we are organisms that reproduce sexually, like other organisms across all different kinds of species that reproduce sexually, that you can see the male-female binary there. Now, in the cases where we're not sure, I would say that I haven't done a deep dive into the therapeutics and the other medical treatments for intersex condition. I'm familiar with some where we can identify. Normally, we would look at someone's chromosomes, and usually I would say that the presence of a Y chromosome, not always, but usually, is a good indicator that someone is male. So we have Klinefelter syndrome. Are men that have more feminine features, they're XXY. So I would say it's a combination. I think heavy weight would be given to genotypes and chromosomes. And then you would just do a holistic analysis of the person's hormones, skeletal structure, genetics, sexual organ development. And you would assign weight to things based on their normative development in human anatomy. Well, like I said, I don't have a comprehensive approach medically how one would do that in the extremely hard cases. And I'm familiar with very, very unusual cases where we're not sure. But as I would say, the fact that there may be some of these cases where we're not sure, that doesn't disprove the existence of a binary between male and female. I actually have posed this question to Father Tad Baholchek before at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and they have some more resources on the subject that can deal with the specific diagnosis of those who identify as intersex. But what's important, and what I commended James White for in my episode, was that he was right in that episode when the host wanted to talk about intersex, that this does not have anything to do with transgender identity, because 99% of people who identify as transgender do not identify as intersex. Their biological sex is easily determined. And so I hope that's helpful for you. And I'd recommend for you and our other listeners, check out the National Catholic Bioethics Center, ncbcenter.org. They have some more resources on the subject.
Thanks, Noah. That brings us to our break. We'll take a break. Trent Horn is our guest. You're welcome to call with your questions. Tips for defending the faith today, 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, "Why don't you air these people?" And I said, "No, because I don't think they're Catholic." He says, "By what right do you have to say that?" I said, "I own the network."
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Tips for defending the faith this hour with Trent Horn. Your call is welcome. 888-318-7884. It's December deal days here at shop.catholic.com. You can use the promo code MyDeal22 to save an extra 20% off, even when you buy already discounted stuff, and everything's discounted over there. So use MyDeal22 when you shop at shop.catholic.com for your Christmas stuff, and you get an extra 20% off. And pretty much, there's also this other side of it. If your purchase goes over $75, your shipping costs are free. That's for U.S. customers only. It's some kind of, I don't know, anti-internationalist thing we're doing. It's only for U.S. customers, the free shipping. Go to shop.catholic.com, shop.catholic.com. Maybe it's not anti-internationalist. Maybe it's just because it costs a lot to mail outside the U.S. What do you think, Darren? Darren thinks it's the latter. All right. Trent, lots of folks on the line. You ready?
Yeah, let's see where we like to go with.
You literally
had a moment.
Sound like you are not ready. That was the most contradictory. Yeah, I'm ready, because it sounded completely not ready. All right, we're going to Tennessee. John in Tennessee, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. John, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead and ask Trent your question.
Okay. Hey, guys. Hope you're doing well today. Trent, I just want to say I'm very grateful for all the work that you do. I'm looking forward to seeing your discussion on Sola Scriptura later on in March. My question for you is, I know that the church teaches that Jesus is fully present under both species of the Eucharist. And so, you know, in situations like COVID, where the chalice was unavailable, the host was the only avenue. And so I was wondering what the logic or the reasoning was behind the church's teaching on this.
Behind the teaching of the Eucharist being presented under both species? I want to make sure I understand your question.
No, I'm sorry. That Jesus is fully present in each individual host.
Oh, right. Well, the idea that, so you're saying that it, contrary to the idea that when we receive Christ in the sacrament, okay, so the idea is, so when we receive Jesus in the Eucharist, we receive the Jesus's whole and entire body, blood, soul, and divinity, right? So we would, so the church would teach that we would receive that rather than having Christ's body broken or divided in some kind of way. And I think a lot of the reasoning that would go related to that, like if we go back to St. Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologia, he talks about how Christ is present in the Eucharist, but not present in the same way that a body is present in space, with some kind of a strict three-dimensional restriction. Okay, so the fact that Jesus is sacramentally present, though real, and we have popes that refer to Jesus being physically present in the Eucharist, we just have to be careful with the use of the words physical, to not mean that Christ is present under the accidents, for example, of bread and wine, because the accidents of bread and wine still remain. He's present substantially. It's in a physical way, but not in accord with physics, how you or I understand it, like Newtonian physics here in the world around us. So I would say that it would go back to that understanding, like what Aquinas says about Jesus being sacramentally present, though real and substantially present. And through that, through that mystery of the Eucharist, we are able to fully receive Christ's body, his glorified body given to us. It doesn't have to be divided or partitioned in any way. So I hope that that was helpful for you. And yeah, if you ever have any other further questions on that or other subjects, definitely give us a call back.
Thanks, John. Thank you very much. All the lines full now. So off to Honolulu we go. Matt in Honolulu, Hawaii, listening on Catholic.com. What's it like, about 1:15 in the afternoon in Honolulu? No. 12:15.
Yes, that is. That's correct.
Oh, 1:15. Okay. Well, very good. Now, you had lunch, and now you're calling Trent.
Right. Thank you for taking my question. So I've always been interested in the, like, contemplative, mystical aspects of the Catholic religion, cradle mm-hmm. Catholic. Earlier in life, I've even discerned to be a Trappist monk, mm-hmm. but, you know, wasn't ready for it at that time. And now that I'm married for 5 years and we're contemplating having children, do you think it's still possible to live a contemplative life and seek, like, mystical experiences while working a full-time job, marriage, children, or they're kind of contradict each other?
No, I don't think that they're contradictory, but I do think it's going to be more difficult to lead a strictly contemplative life and seek mystical experiences with God when one is married. And this goes all the way back to apostolic times, as St. Paul notices this. He talks about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where he says that, you know, if you marry, you do well. And however, he says that those who do not marry, he wishes all like him. He wishes all could be like him. Paul talks about how the unmarried man is anxious to please the Lord, but the married man is anxious to please his wife. And being someone who, coming up here in a few months, is celebrating his 10th wedding anniversary, I could say that's very true. That you have a vocation when you are married. You form a domestic church, so this is something that you have to oversee, and the duties that are involved in that can make it very difficult to seek out a lot of time for contemplation. Many of the greatest mystics in the church's history, think about the ascetics. They just go off into the desert and spend all of their time in prayer. That is not something that is going to be available to most married people, and you probably shouldn't do that, or at least you shouldn't. You should always find time to yourself for prayer, but lengthy times in prayer and contemplation can hinder your ability to spend time with your family, to work, to develop your relationships with your wife and your children. But I do think there's opportunities to at least seek contemplative times, times to go just to be at an adoration chapel or to spend personal time in prayer. Because if you don't do any of that, then you're not going to serve your vocation well at all. Other things that you can do is you can consider joining a secular order. So I believe, for example, that Third Order Franciscans are often comprised of married individuals, and so they're able to enter into religious life. It's not a vowed religious life, as far as I understand, but it's a way to formally put oneself in a situation where you can be more open to have these prayerful experiences and a spiritual life that lead one open to the life of contemplation. But what's wonderful about our faith is that you can be a saint and you can be married. Saint Therese of Lisieux's parents, Zelie and Luis Martin, for example, are a wonderful example of that. So that might be, I would say, is seek contemplation, just the little bits of time where you can, and it will grow over time, especially when you cut out the less important things that tend to distract us. Because honestly, you could be an unmarried person and be distracted by the world and be unable to lead a contemplative life. A lot of it rests within ourselves, but also to not say, oh, well, I don't want to do Lectio Divina. I don't want to go to adoration because I'm not going to have these experiences that a mystic would who spends all their time in prayer. No, you might not, but you'll have experiences that are fitting for your state in life, and those are good and beautiful to behold, so why wouldn't we seek them out? And they are gifts of God. They're not things that we earn by praying really hard. They're gifts from us entering into that intimate communion with God. And all of us should do that, whether we are married, religious life, ordained, or still discerning. Is that helpful, Matt?
Yeah, that's a great answer. Just one more. Can you think of any examples of, like, married mystics, or would that be St. Therese's parents or anyone else?
Jacques Maritain,
maybe. Jacques Maritain? Yeah. Maybe he and his wife were, at least they seem quite mystic to me, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that one off the top of my head, married people who at least had mystical experiences. I know wonderful married authors, theologians, who have done tremendous good for the church that any married couple should emulate. Alice and Dietrich von Hildebrand, for example, would be one that instantly come to mind for myself up in more of the modern era. But yeah, otherwise, if you know any, definitely pass them along my way. But thanks for calling.
Matt, since you're here, can I ask you a question?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you know anything about Oahu Catholic Radio?
I have not. I've heard that it's supposed to be coming.
Yeah, they're working
soon.
On it. A bunch of people here in San Diego are participating in that. Some folks we know who started some radio stations here. And you could, I just want to let people know, if you're listening in Hawaii, you can go to OahuCatholicRadio.com. You can find out the effort to bring a big radio station to the big city in Hawaii there in Oahu. So, Matt, check it out. I think they had an article in your diocesan newspaper recently as well. But I hope there'll be people that will support that effort, because, boy, it would be wonderful to have a Catholic radio station there. Okay, Matt?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Peace, brother. That was totally self-serving, Trent, because I want, like, when they do their fundraisers, to get invited over to Oahu. I'm just trying to get a station on the air so that I can get invited over there. It's
what
a
if
scam.
They
it's a whole
you,
scam
Cy?
That I'm doing. Yeah, go ahead.
What if you get there and they say, Cy, we're so glad that you're here. Here is your schedule. And it's like from dawn until 11 p.m. you're just in a radio booth just doing fundraising.
I don't care. I'll be in Hawaii. I don't even care. I don't even care. Don't at all. Even, no.
Rather be in an office building in Hawaii.
Right.
I mean,
it's like a bad day fishing is better than a good day at work. Yeah,
except
a bad day
in Hawaii. You live in San Diego. That's the Hawaii of the contiguous United States. So.
Well, thank you very much. I take that as a compliment. But I think that might actually be Miami. But yeah, I'd rather be in Hawaii. All things considered,
fair.
I'd rather be in Hawaii.
If they ever need anyone else to go along with you to handle a few apologetic questions,
yeah,
I might have some freedom in my schedule, so
well,
I'm happy to join you.
Darren never wants to travel, and I bet he'd be like, let's go over there and do the radio show over there. I'll set it up for you. We'll do the radio show. Me and the five kids, Rena, we'll all come over with you. Len in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. You are next, Len. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi there. So my son asked this question, and I'm hoping you can give him a better answer than I did. So we're starting with the understanding and the premise that prior to the fall, Adam and Eve were perfect and sinless. And therefore, you know, by definition, they exercised perfect judgment. And so the question he had was, if they were perfect and exercised perfect judgment, how is it that they committed misjudgment by falling to Satan?
Right. So to clear this up, I would say that Adam and Eve were sinless. They did not have concupiscence, for example. They did not have an innate attachment or direction to sin like you and I have. So if you think of concupiscence, it's sort of like, imagine a car with a warped axle. If you don't correct the wheel at all, the car will always slightly veer off the road if you don't do anything. Because we are conceived with original sin, and those effects still remain, if we do nothing to correct those inclinations, we will end up in sin. But Adam and Eve weren't like that. They had axles that were perfectly straight. However, one could still voluntarily turn the wheels and drive off of the road, which is what happened with Adam and Eve. So it wasn't like that they were created in a condition where they were incapable of sinning. Rather, they did not have these inclinations to sin. They were given preternatural gifts of wisdom and understanding and friendship with God, but they were not omniscient. They were not perfect. You know, it depends what you mean by perfect. There's some things about them that represented perfections, but they were not perfect beings because they were still limited, for example. And because they have free will, they're tempted to particular sins. Now, they would not have been tempted to sins of the flesh like you or I, because they lacked concupiscence. So what Aquinas says is that Adam and Eve would have been tempted by the sins of the sins that tempted the angels. So your son's objection, what's interesting here, is that it actually has more force if we swap out Adam and Eve and we put Satan in there. Right. You know, if God created Lucifer, he became Satan, creates Lucifer, the devil, who is an angelic being, highly intelligent, doesn't even have a body to have bodily desires. Right. Angels can't be tempted by bodily passions. Why would the devil sin? And the general conclusion there is that it would be a sin of the intellect, allowing the intellect to engage in faulty reasoning so that one loves something of this world rather than God. And the primary intellectual fault would probably be pride. Just as the devil succumbed to his own pride, Adam and Eve did the same, thinking that they knew better than what God was telling them. So they were sinless, but they were not perfect in the sense that God is perfect, because they're limited creatures capable of making errors or capable of exercising free will to engage in a kind of intellectual sin like pride or something like that. So that's probably how I would go about looking at the question. Is that helpful?
Len? Are you there with us, Len?
I hope he didn't drive his car off the road.
No, he didn't. He didn't drive.
No.
You're still okay, Len. Okay, good.
Still okay. Thank you. All right.
He's got a good axle and a good handle on the wheels. That's good to hear.
All right. Well, you can hear the music playing. We got to take a quick break. Trent Horn with us this hour. Next hour, Father Tad is back. Father Tad Boholczyk from the National Catholic Bioethics Center to talk about bioethics. Your call welcome this hour if you've got want a tip for defending the faith. 888-318-7884.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm not mentally here for the program anymore. I'm just thinking about Hawaii now. I just got Hawaii on the brain. They got a station in Kona, Hawaii. Did you know that? On the Big Island. But I don't know if they got stations there. Oh, there used to be a station on Maui, but I don't know if there's still a station on Maui. But
did it get overrun by all the lava? Is it just like?
Oh, the lava's not in Maui. Yeah, no. You mean on the Big Island? Yeah. No, I don't think so. Although there is some kind of highway that's being threatened by a volcano. I don't really want to live somewhere where stuff gets threatened by volcanoes. I got to rethink this. But they don't. I think you're safe in Oahu.
Well, you live in California. It's basically just a volcano that, you know, doesn't let anything come up from under the earth, like with earthquakes.
Well, yeah, okay, but say someone said to you, "Hey, I could shake you really hard, or I could pour this hot lava all over you." Which would you choose?
I guess I wonder how hard they're shaking me and how hot the lava is, but fair enough.
Lava's very hot.
It's a fair distinction there.
888-318-7884. Cora Evans was a married mystic. Her name has been submitted for canonization. I have no idea where that information came from. Someone just put it on the sheet here, so I thought I'd say that. Do you know her? You ever met her?
I do not. I'm not familiar with her, so it's something to look into.
The number is 888-318-7884. We got Trent Horn here with us. If you got a question for Trent about how to defend the Catholic faith, maybe even, some aspect of the Catholic faith, like belief in God, for example, or Trent's really good at that. He wrote Answering Atheism, a very fine book. 888-318-7884. Going to Aaron in Hastings, Michigan. Now, watching on YouTube. Aaron, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, Trent. Hi, sorry. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, happy to.
Yeah, the question I had, how do we prove that Mary was always a virgin?
Sure. Well, I would say that when we put forward a theological position, we have to ask, what are our sources of divine revelation? What means does God use to teach us truths about revelation? Okay. So as Catholics, we would believe in kind of a three-pronged approach. We believe in God's word that has been given to us in a written form in sacred scripture and an unwritten form in sacred tradition, and that Christ established an authoritative enduring church with a teaching office, the magisterium. So the magisterium teaches that Mary always remained a virgin, though most people probably want to say, well, why should I believe that? Are there good reasons to think that? Yeah, I would say that there are. So I think the approach that I might take is one, to answer defeaters to the claim that Mary was always a virgin, and then two, provide some positive evidence for thinking that Mary remained a virgin and never engaged in sexual relations. Oh, and then three, before I even start, I might ask, why does any of this matter at all? Because some people say, well, what does it matter if Mary was a virgin? Is the church saying sex is bad, so Mary could never have engaged in this? No, that's not what the church is saying. Now, I would say that I would ask a Protestant, why is it important that Mary was a virgin prior to Christ's birth? Why is the virgin birth important? And I think many would say, well, because one, it happened. Okay. And then two, because it shows that Christ had no earthly father. The fact that there were no, that Jesus did not have any older siblings helps to provide evidence that he is unique. He is the only begotten son of Mary. It provides evidence for Jesus only having a heavenly father, not an earthly father. He has an adoptive father, but not a biological earthly father. So if that reasoning applies to Jesus not having older siblings, it applies to Jesus not having younger siblings. So Protestants and Catholics agree Jesus doesn't have older siblings. They just disagree about whether there are younger siblings or not. So I would go past the defeaters. So for example, like the Brethren of the Lord, I would show that the word brother does not necessarily have to mean biological brother. It's most often used in the New Testament, adelphos, to refer to adoptive siblings. Like a brother or sister in Christ means God the Father has adopted both of us. That's why we're brothers. We're adoptive siblings. And so you could argue that they are cousins, or you could argue that the Brethren of the Lord are children from Joseph's previous marriage. There's even Protestants who argue for that. Richard Bauckham is a Protestant who argue, he denies the perpetual virginity of Mary, but he argues that the fact that Mark 6:3 refers to Jesus as the son of Mary, which is a old description. Usually you're only referred as the son of your mother if your mother was very famous. But normally he's the son of Joseph, unless he's in Nazareth. That would be a sign that Jesus was born from Joseph's second marriage, not his first. Not every Catholic agrees with this view, but you're free to. And I think it's interesting that Bauckham and some other Protestants are very open to it. So one, I would remove the defeaters, right? Those would be the things that say, and there's two kinds of defeaters, undercutting and rebutting. But for simplicity, I'll just say, let's deal with the things that would say Mary is not a virgin, like that the Brethren of the Lord. Okay. And there's others I might go to. I won't get into them here. After that, then I would say, okay, we have no positive evidence to say that Mary failed to remain a virgin. Do we have any evidence that for her perpetual virginity? And I might point to a few passages in Scripture at this point. The greeting that Mary gives when the angel Gabriel says to her that you will conceive a child, and she says, how can that be since I know not man? I mean, she was at this point already legally married to Joseph. That's why Joseph was considering divorce. They weren't just engaged. So the fact that they are legally married, that she's going to give birth to a child, that shouldn't be that surprising, unless Mary had already made some kind of a vow of virginity. Now, that might seem a bit unusual, I would then go to the tradition, to the early sources. I would note that the first individuals to challenge the perpetual virginity of Mary come centuries later, and they're a minority among the church fathers. That would be Helvidius and then Tertullian. Tertullian did this after he left the church. And then I would note that amongst this testimony, it goes back pretty early. We have the infancy gospel of James, dated to the beginning of the second century, that tells the story about Mary being raised as a consecrated virgin in the temple and then being married to Joseph, who was a widower, in order to protect her. And I think there's a lot of good evidence, especially among ancient Eastern sources, that there was this understanding of Mary and Joseph and her perpetual virginity. So I think what I would go there is, you know, clarify the doctrine. I would answer objections to it that try to show Mary engaged in sexual relations. Then I would mount some positive evidence for it from Scripture and then also from tradition, noting that we have this early historical agreement about Mary remaining a virgin fairly early on. So if you would like to go, Aaron, even more in depth on that, I would recommend the book Behold Your Mother by my colleague Tim Staples. He has several chapters just on this question. I also address it in my book, The Case for Catholicism. But that was a lot. Of course, you did ask me to defend a dogma that many Protestants are critical of, so I gave you a lot. Is that at least a helpful start?
Yeah. I used to have the Behold Your Mother, but I don't know what in the world I did with it.
Well, I tell you what, Aaron, let's remedy that. Why don't we send you a copy of Behold Your Mother? If you stay on the line, I will gladly send you a copy.
Hang on. Actually, you know what?
Oh, thank you.
He says he'll send it to you, but Edgar's going to send it to you. So hang on and talk to Edgar. Edgar will get your address. We can send Behold Your Mother to Michigan, right? Yeah, we can mail to Michigan. I know we can.
You can still say it, Cy, by a relation, you know, as a figure of speech. For example, when it says in Scripture that Pilate flogged Jesus, he didn't do it himself. He had an underling do it.
That's right. So we'll have a underling do it. Excuse me, underling? You sent him a book? 888-318-7884, the number.
Maybe underling might be a bit...
no, that's a perfect word for Edgar.
Should we have minion?
Let's put that by on his door. Minion? Maybe minion.
How about a minion? One of our minions will do it.
The world's biggest minion. That's a giant minion in there.
Tell Edgar, I would love to see him be dressed up as a minion for next Halloween.
The thing about this, that people may not know, that you and Edgar have physically fought one another. Like you
have
thrown punches and kicks at one another. And
it was fun. It was a gentleman's Muay Thai kickboxing spar, and perhaps we'll have. And perhaps we'll do it again. Maybe we'll do it in the studio next time. We'll do it for the next Catholic Answers Live.
I don't think he can fight at all until after July, because he's getting married in July. Edgar's got a big wedding coming up, so we have to keep him healthy. We can't have you hurting him.
She can still say no if he.
If you disfigure him in some way. Yeah, like I can't. Not with that scar on your cheek. No, she's not going to reject him. I'm just saying we got to keep him healthy till his wedding. Let's go to Nathan in Texas, watching on YouTube. Nathan, go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me. I'm not a Catholic, but I'm strongly considering converting. But my brother is a Reformed Christian, and we've been... Sorry?
He said, oh, wow.
Oh, I said, oh, wow. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. But my brother, he's a Reformed Christian, and we've been having a discussion about salvation through faith alone and not through works and faith. And I was wondering exactly what the point I'm towards. It seems like I don't have the Bible verses off the top of my head, but it seems like every time I point him towards something, he just says, "Oh, well, that's not what they meant," or "This is what they meant." And he's been sending me like R.C. Sproul and different things like that.
Yeah, sure. Well, what I would recommend here, Nathan, and since we only have a little bit of time for our break, I'd like to get your email address. Because I want to send, I want to send you a book, Jimmy Akin's The Drama of Salvation. But in particular, Jimmy, my colleague, recently wrote an article on faith and works. That when we use that framework, I think that Protestants, there's a lot of opportunity for misunderstanding. That thinking that, to be saved, we have to do a combination of faith and works, and you have to do a certain number of works in order to be saved. And that's not what Catholics believe. We would say we're saved by grace alone, apart from faith or works. For example, when a baby is baptized, the baby doesn't have faith and he doesn't have works. He's saved by grace alone. And then he manifests the fruit of baptismal grace through the gift of faith. And then the only work he or she must do to attain heaven is to not die in a state of mortal sin. And every Christian believes, almost every Christian believes that in order to go to heaven, you just can't do something that would sever your faith in Christ. Even Christians who believe you can't lose your salvation, they would say if somebody became an atheist for the rest of their lives, then you would only prove you were never saved in the first place or something like that. So we're actually much closer together than people realize. Sometimes we just need better language to express it. So I'd like to send you Jimmy's book and the article talking about how the phrase faith and works can be misleading and how we need a better way to reframe the discussion with our Protestant brothers and sisters.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nathan. What an encouraging call to us. If there's any way we can be helpful to you as you consider coming into full communion with the Catholic Church, call again. Or you can always send us an email to radio@catholic.com. We have an underling who checks that account, radio@catholic.com. I got to take a break, huh? Do I have to take a break, Darren? I got to take a break. All right, I'm going to see you in a couple minutes, Trent. I'm going to just dream about Hawaii for 2 minutes.
Well, let's see. Let our minions get to work. Or our flying monkeys. You could call them that, our flying monkeys.
You can't call them a flying monkey? No, that's a. Now you've messed up my thinking about Hawaii. All right, I got to think about Hawaii. All right, right back. More Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Seraphic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
One of the greatest theologians and Franciscan mystics in church history, Bonaventure also wrote a biography of St. Francis that was commissioned by the Franciscans themselves. It took a saint and true mystic to understand a true saint and mystic. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Our guest, the Wicked Witch of the Midwest, Trent Horn. Because that's what you are. You're the if you have flying monkeys working for you, you just made yourself into the Wicked Witch of the West. The
Wicked Witch of the Midwest, perhaps.
Yeah, that's where you are now because you moved east from us. So now you're the Wicked Witch of the Midwest.
Maybe I could just be the mildly rude warlock of the Midwest. Like, I'm not wicked, but like, I'm not the nicest person.
Boy, is that the truth. 888-318-7884. Isn't that what you weren't expecting me to agree with you? 888.
You just want my magic. You just want my magical flip-flops so you can have all of my mildly rude powers.
I would like that. Yes, I would. I didn't know that that was even up for discussion. If there's a possibility of that, I'd like to get those magic flip-flops. 888-318-7884.
The tornado. It's pretty easy out here.
Grace in South Bend, Indiana. What's that in South Bend? Some kind of Catholic school there. Listening on Redeemer Radio.
Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah, Notre Dame. That's right. Glad you're here, Grace. Go ahead with your question.
I've talked with my brother before, and he'll lead me to scenarios, and then he'll say, okay, do you agree that God is outside of time and space? And I'll say, yeah. And then he'll say, then do you agree? Like, God already knows whether you made it to heaven or hell. And then that's where I'm like, oh, I'm just not certain on that. If God, if he's outside of time and space, like, knows if we made it to heaven or hell, and then that brings up questions with me, like, then the second coming would have already happened. And, yeah, that's my question.
Okay, Grace. Trent?
Yeah, sure. Well, Grace, what I would say there, I would like to answer this question, and I would like to stay as accessible as possible, because the question of God's relationship to time kind of relates to the question of what time is like, which can get very complicated very quickly. If we need to go there, we can. But I would just say that God is all-knowing, right? God is not ignorant. God created the entire universe. He's infinite, perfect being itself. So God is not limited in his power, and he's not limited in his knowledge as well. Therefore, God knows if certain propositions are true or false. For example, there is a proposition, Trent Horn spends eternity with God. And these propositions could be phrased in a temporal or a timeless way. That's where it gets sticky. But I would just say there are truths about whether Trent Horn goes to hell or Trent Horn goes to will go to heaven. God knows those. God is aware of every moment of time because God possesses all of his life in one simultaneous perfect moment. So I believe it was the philosopher Boethius who described eternity as the interminable, perfect and complete, simultaneous and complete possession of life, of interminable life. So God is eternal, not in the sense of being everlasting. So like we will have endless life. It'll either be with God or apart from God. We have everlasting life. We will live for an endless period of time. But we do not have eternal life in the same way that God is eternal. God is eternal because God possesses all of his infinite life in one perfect moment. God does not change. God is not in time. He's outside of time. So God knows what will happen to us tomorrow, whether we will get on the bus tomorrow or whether we will get hit by the bus tomorrow. And he will know where we will go after we get hit by the bus, whether it's the hospital or another place in the afterlife. So he knows that, but the fact that God knows what will happen, that does not determine what will happen. Our free choices determine what will happen. To make an analogy, and it's a very rough analogy, so it limps, but it's still serviceable. If I am on top of a very high skyscraper and I see two cars traveling at very high speeds, I know that they are going to get into an accident. And then I see them collide. But it doesn't follow the fact that I knew that they were going to collide. My knowledge determined that that was going to happen. And so there's something similar with God's knowledge of us, that God does know the future because otherwise he'd be ignorant. The Bible is very clear. He has a plan for us. He predestines us. He has that plan. But his plan takes into account our free choices. This is made clear in paragraph 600 of the Catechism. So that's a start about divine foreknowledge and human freedom. Is there any clarification you would like on that, or how is that as a start?
So God knows what my free will is going to choose in the future?
Yes, there's different ways you can hash that. Yeah,
it sounds like predestination, but it's...
Sure.
You know,
well, let me look at it this way, Grace. God knows, he's watching you right now, right? He knows what you're going to do right now. But the fact that you know he knows what you're doing right now, you're still free to do whatever you want. There is, God, that moment in his now, it's present in the eternal now, just like tomorrow, what you do tomorrow, what color shirt you're going to wear. It's not like he's looking forward into the future, wondering what you were doing. He sees you in the future, acting in the future, is present as the now for him. It's like he's watching you live in the future. It's happened for God. It just hasn't happened for you yet. But you're still freely acting at that future moment. God observes it, and he knows what you choose to do. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is that the reason God knows what we will do in the future is because when God created the world, he knows not just what we can do or what we will do, he knows what we would do, freely do, in any given circumstance. This is called middle knowledge. So he just knows the moment, once the world is created, logically, not temporally, he knows what we would do in any circumstance. He knows if somebody gives me a gift card for Brahms, I'm going to buy a mint chocolate chip ice cream because it's my favorite. He just knows that's what I would do in that circumstance. So God creates the world knowing there are different circumstances. He plans it based on what people would do. They still freely choose. And he is aware of what they freely choose. I don't want to overburden you too much. This can be a very tough subject. But either model you take, you just have to remember that God knows the future, but his knowledge doesn't determine it, okay? So we are still free to act. He is just not limited in what he knows about what we will do. So I'll throw the life preserver out there again. How is that moving forward a little?
I'm going to listen to the recording of this. I think I'll need some time to absorb it, but
I think that's fine, Grace. It can be a little tough. So I tell you what, if you could send us your email address, I would love to send you some supplemental articles at Catholic Answers that might break it down a little bit more. But I guess for me, what makes you think, like, if God knows what you're doing tomorrow, are you having a concern about how God knows what you're going to do, or more of a concern like, how am I free if he knows what I'm going to do?
Yeah, and I'm also thinking in the long term, like, that for certain people, they're just fallen people then, and then it's just hard to think about how they aren't determined to that.
They're fallen people because
they do that.
Okay, so you agree God... So do you think God can know whether we go to heaven or hell? Do you think, like, that's within his power to know that?
I think after talking with you, yes.
Okay, sure.
Before,
so let's say he does have that power.
I didn't know if it was like our free will was to determine it.
Our free will determines it, but God knows what we choose to do, either by, he observes, like he, and I like that analogy of how I see the traffic on the street from my perspective high up. I see what's going to happen. Something similar with God, that because he's timeless, he sees every moment as if it is the present. And so it's like he knows the future like he knows the present. He just sees it. And so that's how he knows, because we don't see it yet, but he does, and we're freely acting in that moment. So is your concern, we got a little bit of time before we close the show out. It seems like you're like, okay, God can know whether we're going to go to heaven or hell. Is your concern, like, if God knows that like maybe we're kind of destined for one or the other?
Yeah, and it seems like our free will I get what you're definitely saying.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great, and I'm glad that you're thinking really hard about this, because one of the hardest things to think about is God and time, and when you put the two together, it really stretches your brain. But I think what we can understand is that God knows, whether it's heaven or hell, this applies to anything, even if I choose to eat Cheerios or Raisin Bran tomorrow. The question is, does God, knowing I do that, it would be weird if God, like, was sitting next to us and he's in time, and he tells me, hey, here's what you're going to do tomorrow. And I'm like, oh, okay, it seems like it's been fixed. But, and I know it's just so hard for us, it's hard to think about what our future selves do until we get there. But there is a theory of time that says the past, present, and future are equally real. And the present is a conscious reality we become aware of. But there are on this. And so in that case, it may be, oh, wow, if it's all equally real, God just sees it. And my future self, that is me, just at a different time, just like you can have me at a different place, acts, and I'm freely acting at that moment. But give us your email, Grace, and I would be happy to send you some supplementary articles to break this down even more.
Okay, Grace?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's
an
excellent conversation. Really enjoyed that. And I hope you'll call again, Grace, especially when your brother brings up more stuff. Trent, maybe tell us a little bit about what's coming up at Council of Trent, your podcast, at TrentHornPodcast.com.
Sure. Well, I just released an episode today commenting on Cameron Bertuzzi's conversion to Catholicism and Protestant apologist Gavin Ortland's thoughts on that. So I've just released that. I have a few other episodes coming out this week. For our patrons, you're going to get a sneak peek at the new studio. So you see part of it behind me. I'm kind of still a mystery for now. Mm-hmm. Our patrons will get to see the new studio. And then in the new year, everybody will get to see the brand new Council of Trent studio.
So is that why we got just a corner right now? Like, I'm trying to look around and see if I can see more of it? Because
just a corner, just this pinch. I want a way to make it a bit more dramatic for the reveal.
How much
but
does
it might be here on Catholic Answers Live?
Oh,
in
it
a
might?
Month or so.
Oh, very nice.
I think so, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Trent Horn. Appreciate it. It's always nice talking with you.
Good talking to you as well.
Coming up, Father Tad Boholchik will be here. We haven't had Father Tad on in a while, so I'm looking forward to talking with him. We'll see what's new in the world of biotechnology and what the moral questions are. If you have bioethics questions, give us a call, 888-318-7884.